Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Amy Tan, whose latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. Amy Tan is the author of several other novels, including Joy Luck Club, Bonesetter's Daughter, Saving Fish from Drowning. Also, there's a memoir and two children's books, the libretto for an opera, which we will talk a little bit about, and a PBS TV series based on one of those children's books. But this book, as with your other novels, deals with mother-daughter relationships and deals specifically with, I guess, the idea that your grandmother might have been a courtesan in China around 1910. You had been working on a novel basically set in a small village in China, and you were looking through photos because I guess there was going to be a sequence with courtesans, and suddenly you saw a photo of these 10 Shanghai women. You said, that could be my grandmother.
It was even more striking, actually. These women were called the 10 Beauties of Shanghai, 1911, and five of them were wearing an outfit identical to what my grandmother was wearing. And my first thought was, well, that's a pretty popular outfit. I read more about the clothing and about courtesans and discovered that the clothing details were actually specific to courtesans, as was the setting, the Western photo studio. And that set me on a trek, obsessive trek, into learning more about courtesan culture.
And you had known there were pictures of your grandmother, but there was no idea at the time that...
I didn't know the significance of the clothing details or the posture or the photo studio. And I still can't say, of course, with any certitude that she really was a courtesan. Family history or lore seems to make that implausible. But other family accounts, family research that I've made also make it quite possible. So it just depends on which side of the family lore I choose to follow.
Your cousin wasn't happy with this.
No. She emphasized that the family was wealthy, so she had no reason to do that. She was quiet. She was traditional and old-fashioned and never would have thought that. What was striking to me in her comment is that it was the same notion that many people have that is stigmatized that women in circumstances like that, that somehow it was their own choosing, as if they had made a career choice based on insatiable sex desire. Whereas many of these women had been kidnapped or forced, sold by family members, or forced by poverty to become courtesans, and would have been lucky to be courtesans instead of ordinary streetwalkers. So it was also understanding that, you know, people would have this misperception. The part that definitely wasn't true, however, is the old-fashioned part, the quiet part. In talking to other people, family members, I discovered she was actually quite foul-tempered and had a very strong opinion about many things. Part of my discovering the significance of the photo, whether she was a courtesan or not, was this sense that she had come alive. And I thought to myself, if somebody had said about me that she was quiet and traditional and that she was a good cook and a seamstress and never did anything improper, it would be as though I had really died many different ways, that I didn't exist. And so when I discovered that my grandmother really had a much stronger personality, I felt she'd been resurrected. And that made me very happy. The other part is a mystery. The mystery includes why would she have come to be wearing those clothes? And if it was done as a lark, why? If it wasn't, you know, why? So it unleashed a number of things. But what I was most caught by was the possibility that she had been, and I wanted to know what that world was like, what the circumstances were, what kind of attitudes and beliefs that she would have had about the world she was in, as well as about others. How could she trust people? What did she think of herself in comparison to what people thought of her?
What happened was you'd been working on a book, but suddenly you needed to follow your obsession.
Yes, which is the way I've always written. It's just that one obsession became stronger than the other. Both of them started, however, with a question about self-identity and who are we and who do we become? What are the influences that shape who we become? And that's why I'm so keen to know more about my grandmother, my ancestors.
Let's go back a little bit and pull it all together. So this earlier novel that you were working on was going to take place in a village that wound up to be the village in Valley of Amazement, the small segment of the story. But originally you went to China, and there's a photo of a place called Dimen or Dimen, which I guess inspires Heavenly Mountain and the village.
Yes. Dimen. It's a village where the Dong minority live, and they're rice farmers. That area of China is the poorest and most remote of all the provinces in China. And we went there, Stuart Wallace and I, a composer of the opera, we went there to do some research on the singing culture. But in doing so, also came to know a lot more about the life of those people there. I went back a couple of times more to do research for an article on that place for National Geographic.
That's the town that you call Moon Pond.
Moon Pond. And Moon Pond is actually a couple of villages merged together. There was a village I also went to in Anhui Province, which is about 250 miles from Shanghai. Very tiny little village where many of the young people have already moved out to go to the big city to work. And there is a pond there called Moon Pond. And we got to stay, Lisa C. and I. We went together. We always wanted to travel together. And we went to this little city that had one of its homes removed and sent to the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem. And we stayed in the other one that was still there in the village, a 400-year-old mansion belonged to a merchant. Multiple rooms, obviously. He had multiple wives. And so Lisa and I got to see what it's like to live in a 400-year-old house and pretend to be one of two of the wives. And it was miserable. It was cold. It was so cold. And I slipped a number of times in the mossy, you know, corridors there. And she was so right. I wanted to stay there for 2 weeks before I went there, thinking I could write in the wonderful romantic environment of a little village and little geese cackling outside. And now Lisa said we should stay there a maximum of 4 days.
Sounds like Violet's fantasies of what it would be like
exactly,
were yours.
Exactly. I put that down. She's thinking she's going to be the scholar's wife, you know, in a garden of repose and meditating on immortality or something. Yeah. The only immortality is that you would die and remember forever how miserable you were.
You began writing that novel, and there was going to be a sequence involving a courtesan, which is how you began.
In a way, I went to the Asian Art Museum in San Francisco. It was an exhibit on Shanghai, and at one point I saw an illustration of a courtesan, a bunch of courtesans. And the docent said that courtesans actually had been quite instrumental in bringing Western culture into popularity in Shanghai, furniture, food, clothing. That they also had the greatest independence of all the women of any class during that time. They could move about freely, make their own decisions. It was a very limited amount of freedom once they were not courtesans. They descended into a life that was quite different. But to me, the idea of independent women who had influence on culture, on history in a way, fascinated me. And so I thought of including a courtesan, possibly, as a side character, somebody who this main narrator would run into, not knowing that I would suddenly take the book apart and make the courtesan the lead character.
You did something else, which is you made the choice to make this character, Violet, to give her an American mother who is kind of the madam of this courtesan place, a hotel, whatever
house,
it is.
A social club.
Hidden Jade Path. In so doing, you bring in the American element, viewing Shanghai and courtesans almost from an American point of view.
Right. Well, I did it for a number of reasons. One is this question of identity that, you know, oftentimes we come from a place and we're very secure and sure of ourselves, assured of our place in society, and suddenly we land in a different country, in a different world, and all of our privileges and assumptions don't work anymore. And that's what happens to this woman, Lucy, Lucia, Lulu, Lucretia. She has many different names. And then her daughter, who also feels she has the privileges of an American. I'm fascinated with the idea of people having to change their self-identity as a result of how they are perceived, their new identity in the country. The other is I'm an American, and I have that point of view, and when I go to China, I take that with me. And I wanted to view that world as I did as an American, looking into history at that time and what was happening, and feeling the significance from that point of view of an outsider, and having that view become much more intimately that of the view I have to live with. So it's necessarily those two viewpoints.
You've chosen to translate the names. The idea, it's a convention from a book called Sing Song Girls of Shanghai, which is to use these adjective names like loyalty, perpetual, rather than the Chinese name.
Right. It would have been very difficult for readers to remember the names. My Chinese name, for example, is Tan Anmei. You could have Tan Anmei, Tan Yuhan, you know, Li Bingzi, all those. And it'd be very hard to keep them straight. Whereas if you just use the names, the portion of the names that are meaningful, then you would be able to understand them, remember them a little bit better. My name, then, is Blessing from America. If I were to translate that and just use my name as a character, it'd probably just be Blessing or Foreign Blessing or something like that. So I use the names. Now, the convention that I used was one chosen by a very well-respected author, Eileen Chang, or Chen Eiling. She was the author of Lust Caution, which is, later was made into a movie more recently. Many acclaimed novels, and she was a translator. She had spoke perfect English. The novel is a classic written in Shanghainese. Sing Song Girl is a terrible word because it comes with it that 60s stereotype of some exotica viewed from an imperialist point of view. But they were the courtesans, basically, the flowers of Shanghai. It was a novel based on his experiences, his nightly forays into the courtesan houses of Shanghai in 1893.
The courtesans themselves, a courtesan is not a prostitute. And I keep thinking, is there a similarity between the courtesan of China and, say, the geisha of Japan?
It would be closer to that than, say, just a courtesan in San Francisco, turn of the century, in a whorehouse. But they were part of the sex trade. You know, if you consider the sex trade anything that involves commerce and sex. So they were courted by men, and they might have had, say, 4, 5, 6 suitors who brought them gifts. These men would be there with their friends. It was more like the Playboy Club. But they were also wooing a particular woman, and the courtesan would be the one who would choose later on which of these men would be granted favors. They would also be working, the courtesans, for a contract with a patron, and that meant a monthly stipend for fidelity for however that period was contracted for. So it was quite different. But they were unlike geishas, because geishas, I think, followed a convention of clothing that did not deviate. You know, they had certain clothing that they always wore, always did their hair in a certain way. Courtesans in China were known for innovation. They were constantly changing their clothes and their hairstyles, looking more Western, and sometimes taking on the clothing of men.
Of course, these courtesans, they start very young because they're kidnapped or whatever, and they're virgins, mm-hmm. and they pay extra to change that. That could be, that's quite a bidding war. But eventually they reach the age of 25 or 27, mm-hmm. and then things get a little dicey.
I think that in reality the courtesans were looking at the end of their careers by their earlier 20s, say the 21, 22. By then they should have found a situation as a concubine in a rich man's house. And if they waited too long, their choices were going to be quite limited, as it is in Violet's case. Very rarely would a courtesan be able to marry as the first wife to a rich man, a well-respected man. And if they did not get a situation as a concubine, they were really looking at sinking into this continuum of the sex trade. Second-class courtesan, streetwalker, somebody worked in a flower opium house, even descending to the gutters, which is what happened to some of the most popular, famous courtesans of their time. You know, pride or whatever had them remaining independent. They wouldn't allow themselves to become concubines. And they ended up dead in the streets, addicted.
The character of Violet goes down a path like that, assisted by her friend, her, I guess, mentor, Magic Gourd. And even though Magic Gourd is constantly giving her warnings, she eventually has to leave and chooses to go off into this small village, which we've spoken of. It seems that from what you're saying now, at the time I'm thinking, God, this guy Perpetual, you've set him up as kind of a creep. I mean, we know that. Why is she doing this? But as you explain it now, in fact, she was looking at her options, and it was better to take a risk that this guy was for real and Moon Pond was a paradise than say, I'll wait for the next one.
Now I'll wait until I'm, you know, now I'm stuck with a rickshaw driver or something. In her desire to have a future of some kind, she, of course, sets up an illusion of this peaceful life. Maybe, she says, maybe he's not the greatest, he's not the most handsome guy, and his poetry that he writes is pretty bad. But
It's not his.
Well, the ones that he did write were pretty bad, which I actually wrote. I had to work really hard to make them bad in a classical way. What she's looking at, dreaming of, is that, you know, meditative retreat. And it's not that way at all. I really was thinking about also women I know who've reached a certain age, and they can either, you know, go on and have a wonderful time with their friends and live alone and have all this independence, or they can marry a creep, you know. Actually, it's not that bad, but I see women who want to marry, and they're with guys who are so beneath them, in my opinion. They don't share the same politics or ideas of generosity and kindness and family, and I think, why are they with them? Very smart women, and, you know, that's like Violet. You know, she's got this notion that her future depends on being with somebody, and that really was true in that day and age. She couldn't go out and get a job as a teacher or go back to school or get on, you know, some kind of assistance, job training assistance. It just didn't exist. So truly her options were limited. Well, you think about what are the possibilities of even a woman not marrying and remaining unmarried, living with her family. Well, her family, after a while, they're not going to be there for her. Parents are going to die. Money has gone off to somebody else, or there is no money. What does she do? When that happened to families, when there was no support, families lost their riches, husbands died or absconded with money or gambled it away, the fate of those women often was to enter into a life of prostitution. That was typical. In those days of Shanghai, one out of every 100 women was and the sex trade.
In Valley of Amazement, you make the choice to give us an in-depth portrait of courtesanship to a point where I'm going, do I really need to know the ins and outs of being a singer?
Well, actually, I took that, you know, the different kinds of singing, and one has, it's really, to me, it was a level about artistry, not just about courtesans and singing, but the way that we do art. So we can master something on a technical level and become very confident, or we can infuse it with a kind of feeling, but it might be too egotistical, or we can communicate with the audience, and we provide something that is genuine in the emotions that the person identifies with, and that becomes the art. And so it was not really just about singing. To me, it was a message about any kind of art and the levels of expertise. Now, in the case of this section, when she talks about how you're in the throes of ravishment, that technique, I took that from watching Long Long, the pianist, play a concert. and how he would look at the audience. It was, the look on his face was obscene, I thought. It was nearly obscene. It was like somebody having an orgasm right on stage. And I said, this is somebody who knows how to connect with the deepest feelings of the audience.
There are several bedroom scenes, and as I was reading them, I kept thinking, Amy Tan is walking a fine line between titillation, a clinical look, and being funny as well. I mean, how did you get that right?
Well, I'm glad you think I got it right. It's very tricky, actually, to write about sex from a point of view that's, you know, very different from intimacy, but also having to do with something quite perfunctory, skillful, something that has to do with commerce, and then just pragmatic. So here is Magicord teaching young Violet what she needs to know, and she very matter-of-factly says, this is what you're going to have to do. Here are the, you know, 9 responses a woman is supposed to show as part of this illusion that the man has aroused something in her and satisfied her completely. And when you look like you're satisfied, the man thinks you're in love. They think that's what love is from a woman. And here are the 2 responses from the man, the male, that you have to work for. So it was just funny things like that where I could talk about what I also think is the difference between men and women, what their desires are that is manifested often through sex, different notions of intimacy and romance, especially romance and ego, you know, this notion of nostalgia, this nostalgia men will have for their ideal selves, what they imagined they would become when they were young, what they imagined. I will be this great man. I will have done this. I will have had these ethics. And having failed that, now having a courtesan who makes them feel that they did accomplish that.
Was that Amy Tan or was that research?
That's my thoughts about human nature. And it's not a criticism at all about anybody I know. I don't know of any particular man who would, you know, I could say that I had based that on. But just knowing, thinking about ourselves, thinking of myself and what I might have wanted when I was younger and who I thought I was and what I believe is this game of illusions that men and women play with one another. It can be fun, it can be necessary, but it also involves deception.
Did any courtesan actually play a banjo?
No, but there are instruments that very much are like banjos. For one thing, the zither has these strings that you pluck, so it's actually sitting like a keyboard, but the strings are plucked, and they can be plucked very, very quickly, like a banjo. So I imagined, you know, they were always innovating fashion, entertainment, and so here you had a courtesan who wants to stand out above the rest in musical ability and plays Chinese or Americanized Chinese music on a banjo instead of a zither.
There's a decision late in the book to tell Lulu's story from her point of view, and we've gone up and we've basically been in Violet's point of view with occasional side trips to Magic Ward. Was that decision always there?
No. I started the book actually with Lulu, her story, so it was going to become more chronological. But then I realized that so much of the story is about our misunderstandings, the misunderstandings between mothers and daughters, and that we interpret their behavior and their intentions on limited information of who they are and what their past was and motivations were. And so I wanted to go through Violet's story with her notions of her mother being there, starting from when she was a little girl, and then our understanding of Lulu later in the story, seeing how she grew up and what kind of life she had that had probably led her to have certain attitudes in life, the kind of hardships she went through, but also a degree of selfishness and self-centeredness that Violet also has, that we see that she has adopted from her mother.
Is that why Lu Xing and Perpetual, mother and daughter, husband slash lover, are both kind of second-rate artists and plagiarists?
They are both second rate in a way, but I think what they are is an imitation of a model of the ideal, and they fall far short, of course. They have fallen in love, both of them, with a romantic illusion of a man, one being the troubled artist who feels that his soul cannot be expressed in his painting, and the other through his poetry, and always denigrating his poetry, but actually thinking that he's quite good, that he's romantic, that he's able to capture the deepest of emotions that no one can. And don't we all feel that, wish that we could, you know, as artists, don't we wish that we could have the ability to completely express ourselves so that others understand us, and that we say something that no one has ever said before. That's the illusion. And we try as best we can, and hopefully we don't promote ourselves so much that people like Violet and Lucia then see into this later and belittle us for it.
When you were in Germany, you saw a painting, which was The Valley of Amazement, and you chose that as the title, even though you haven't been able to find the painting since. What brought you to make the connection between the painting and the book?
The painting gave me a feeling that was a little uncomfortable, and it was that sense of ambiguity you have about something important in your life. And to me, it was a painting about what we're seeing ahead of us or looking behind us. It was not clear in the painting, this valley with mountains, with the storm either coming or going, and light that was either dawn or dusk. It was not clear to me whether we were looking at something good or bad. And it reminded me so many times of places where I've been, where some change has been made. I've made it deliberately, or it has happened to me, and I'm not quite sure it's leading to something I want, or that I'm walking away from something that is, you know, it's a good decision that I should walk away. So, for example, one might be getting married. It's a very big change that's about to happen, and you suddenly, or I did, suddenly thought to myself, what am I doing? Am I going to have to change drastically? What am I losing? Another is leaving a job, not knowing what the next job is, but saying, I just have to leave this job. There are many times in life that I think many people have this sense they have come to a crossroads, not knowing if what they're seeing in the future, if they see anything, is simply a fantasy that's going to evaporate.
Is it kind of presaging that when she sees the village from on high, instead of seeing a sunny village, she sees clouds in the distance?
Well, I think she focuses on what she is feeling. You know, don't you ever have that happen? You're looking at a scene. I've had this happen, looking at an ocean, and when I am feeling rather frightened about something going on in my life, the ocean looks malevolent. Absolutely malevolent. And when I'm feeling wonderful and open about the possibilities in my life, the ocean is magnificent. It has a wonderful deep power to it. And that's what happens when she looks at this village from a distance. She suddenly has trepidation, and she sees the clouds, and she sees something very ominous.
Amy Tan, your books tend to focus on this mother-daughter relationship, and in this case, we have three separate generations of mother-daughter. Obviously, as you go back to it, you're once again trying to find things out about yourself. From this book, what do you get out of watching Violet and Lulu, or Violet and her daughter Flora? What do you come out of it with?
I came out with a better understanding of patterns of abandonment in my family. One is the realization that my mother felt abandoned when her mother killed herself, that she had told me they had to metaphorically tie chains to her ankles so she wouldn't fly off with her mother, and said, please don't go, don't go. And she was left basically with a house full of strangers. My mother, many years later, abandoned her daughters. You know, she left three daughters behind in Shanghai when she went to the United States. And I thought to myself, how could she do this? What was in her that made her think that sometimes a mother must leave her daughters? I also found in writing this notions of independence that run through our family, and traits that I have within me that obviously must have started with my grandmother, or even before with her mother, my grandmother's mother, and has come down through the generations. So this quality of independence, stubbornness, or a kind of persistence my mother emphasized with me. She would say it in such a negative way, though. I wanted to reject it. She would say, you must have a job, a really good job, so that if you ever wanted to leave your husband, if you got married, you could in an instant without even thinking how you would take care of yourself. And I thought, why would you think I would have such a terrible marriage? But what she was saying is that you must always be able to make your own decisions. She also said, you should never let other people judge you and make you feel that's who you are. And she would discount what people said, even if it was good. And I thought that also was a terrible thing to say, that you couldn't trust what people said. If you think about what happened to my grandmother, whether she was a concubine or a courtesan or what have you, you could understand, you could see how any woman in a life like that might have had to develop that attitude in order to keep herself sane, in order to keep herself whole. And that is the kind of understanding I've had by writing this book.
It seems to me, at least in terms of this book, that when you're writing, you're almost in a trance-like state, just trying to let stuff come to the surface, which means that on a second reading, when you're proofing it, do you sometimes sit back and go, I can't believe I wrote that?
I often feel that way. You know, I think the best writing I do is when I'm just submerged into the world and I'm just writing as I see it and feel it. I do have to go back and clean things up, but I think the writing is smoothest when that happens to me. And that only happens to me toward the end of the writing when I pretty much know where the story is going and who the characters are and know what they would likely say. But I also have times when I've struggled and I've written and I go back and reread it and I say, boy, did somebody who was brain damaged write this? I cannot believe these sentences. It's completely incomprehensible. That's what happens when you write at 4 a.m. with very little sleep. And a lot of that was done and I had to completely rewrite things, you know, once I saw those sentences.
But on the other hand, the content is going to be bubbling up from your unconscious, and that's the most important part about that first draft, isn't it?
It is, and it requires a lot of thinking about something. So the first drafts or the false starts are really not a waste of time. It's this amalgam of obsession, the questions, the ambiguity, the things that I've been thinking about, combined with research and narrative and character all come together so that when it does rise at a moment where it seems to just come out naturally, it really has been the result of, you know, years of thought and work.
What do you think is the most surprising thing in the book when you went back and looked at it that you just couldn't believe but it was so perfect for it? Was there anything like that?
Oh, I never think any of my work is perfect. Sometimes I read the story, and I read it then at that point like a story, not like something I'm trying to craft into a story. And I'm surprised that I can just read it that way and get lost in it the same way that I hope a reader does. So much of it comes out as a struggle. And when I see it then and read it in that way, I can really enjoy it and feel the suspense. I think that's what I enjoy the most, is when I can forget how much I had to work on suspense and I can simply read it and it's there for me as well.
Amy Tan, what was it like writing a libretto for your own novel?
That was actually fun. That was play. I always had a lot of wonderment over how operas were created. You know, do you write the words first? Do you write the music first? And it happens in this case simultaneously, working with the composer and understanding his sound world, but casting this more like a play into three acts and into scenes, dividing them into scenes and knowing which parts would have arias, for example, or chorus, and writing from there. But that was absolute joy and fun. The fundraising, the publicity, no. That was really, really hard work. If I only had to do the libretto, just working with the composer and talking about sound world and about emotion and singing and the qualities of sound and voice, then that would be beautiful. Could do that often.
And it had its premiere, right?
It premiered in 2008, and it was really wonderfully received. We had a full house every night. In fact, it was oversold. Tons of publicity and standing ovations every night. More than we could have hoped for.
And the PBS series, when was that?
The PBS series of Sagwa was a cartoon. And, you know, when I would stop myself as we were developing this and think, boy, when I was 7 years old, this would be my fantasy life, you know, to be able to do a cartoon. Cartoons, though, are a lot of work. You know, you're dealing with a lot of budgets and people and unions and who do the cartoons. And then you're dealing with the standards of PBS and Sesame Workshop, which means, for example, that you can't have even the suggestion that a cricket has died. And you have to have a cricket disappear and then reappear again. You're dealing with these elements, and understandably so. You don't want to have a child to have nightmares the rest of their lives. But you are thinking through a different lens, the help of many, many different people.
There's a slight element in Valley of Amazement, maybe it runs through all your books, of almost a magic realism. Does the ghost actually exist?
The ghost in the house could be something in Americans' mind is a wishful thinking about somebody who may be the true love who has evaded you because they've died before you had a chance to meet them. But on the other hand, I have had many experiences with what I can only assume to be spirits. I hate to use the word ghost because it's so loaded. Automatically, your IQ is lowered by 20 points if you say you believe in ghosts. But in another consciousness, another form of that person, a quality of that person that still is around. And I have that often in my life, enough that it really would be almost disrespectful for me to say that it does not exist. I've also had very funny occurrences, manifestations, phenomena that you cannot really explain. The kind of things that are classic, like footsteps running up the stairs, lots of crashing noises, samba dancing, obviously going on upstairs above your head, and you go running up there. You see nothing. You hear nothing except little tittering laughter. I love the fact that other people who have lived in our houses have heard the same thing without any information from me, and they've come to me white-faced in the morning saying, "Is your house haunted? What happened? What did you see? And what did you hear?" And it will be exactly the same things.
So when a courtesan, I think it's Magic Gourd.
Yes.
It's Magic Gourd says, "My true love is the ghost of the poet in this house."
Yes, yes.
You're sort of taking it for real.
Don't think in this case it necessarily was going to be a real ghost in the house. The mother has talked about the poet ghost and set in Magic Gourd in everybody else's mind that there is a ghost there. What Magic Gourd wants, though, is a true love that she's never found. And she feels the wind and she feels the sense of contentment, and she believes that it is the poet ghost. But in her case, in writing about this, there's nothing really tangible that happens with Magic Gourd and this supposed ghost that would make me want to say to you, yes, I intended for this to be a real ghost.
I got the feeling, maybe I'm wrong, but I got the feeling that, you know, a lot of authors talk about one character or one or two characters just kind of taking over, that you didn't really want them to intrude as much as they did, but they just kind of took over. Did that happen with Magic Gourd?
She inserted herself a lot more than I thought. When I was writing this, I had never intended for her to have her own voice. At one point, this friend of mine, Walter Curran, he had become editor of an online publishing company called Byliner, and asked if I had a story that was 15,000 words or more. And I said, no, I don't have anything. I'm writing a novel. But then it occurred to me, well, maybe I'll write a story in a different voice just simply for this magazine. And so I chose the voice of a woman who had no real voice of her own in the story, Magic Cord. And I had her become the mentor, the one who would teach the lessons of being a courtesan. And her voice came so easily to me. She just started ranting and, you know, kind of rambling and just going on. And she was funny to me. And I've heard that voice before. I've had that voice in The Hundred Secret Senses. That voice, too, was the easiest to write. And in the past, I've always thought of that voice as my grandmother's voice. I never met my grandmother, but I just imagined that she had that quality of a woman who has the wisdom that is earned only through hardship, mistakes, and sorrow, and has come out of it strong and with a sense of dignity and humor as a result, or unintentional humor. But that's Magic Cord. And after I wrote that, eventually that became part of the book, and she ended up having more of a voice. You always hear her on this, accompanying Violet, making commentary on what's happening to Violet. Very sympathetic, but also she's easily wounded. So that became Magic Cord, a character I'm very fond of and who just emerged.
At the very end of the book, we see Flora as a young woman. Is that you?
I don't think of Flora as exactly me, but she has a kind of cynicism that I had, and that I think a lot of young women have had or young men have had. You reach a certain age where you don't believe many of the things have been fed to you in society or by your parents. She's also been damaged in a way, wounded by how she's been raised and by separation of her mother from her at a very young age. You know, I've had wounded periods when my father and brother died, and thinking how I had lost a lot of trust in the world. And I think that if you were to see anything of me and Flora, it would be that period of time when I lost trust in the world.
We've talked about several generations of women, and you have no daughter, so it's kind of ending with you. How do you feel about that in retrospect? I mean, it's a little late in the game now.
Yeah. It would take a real medical miracle at this point, plus a complete mind warp in my side of wanting to change diapers. But I don't think of it as being too late. I don't have any genetic replication of myself, and I don't think that that's anything I ever needed or wanted. But I have nieces, and I have other relatives, and it doesn't have to, you know, be necessarily with girls in my family. It could be in many different ways. On the other hand, it's never been in my mind so important to have posterity as part of the way I look at my life. It's fine if my life is contained within this life. It's enough. And if the books go on, or the thoughts that I have or memories of me go on, that's great. But that also is not anything that's highly important. To me, it's always been about feeling and thinking as deeply as I can while I am alive. And if there's anything that remains from that, it will be there of its own accord, not by my forcing it, my desire to have it there in any way. It just would happen.
Amy Tan, have you started work on another book?
I have. I've started on a new novel called The Memory of Desire, and also a nonfiction book on writing.
And is that the book, the essay collection that would contain the essay about the writing of this book that you originally submitted?
Yes. There's an essay about that. There's an essay about what this book is about for me. You know, I'm asked so often, what is the book about? And it's the most impossible question. If I knew it, I wouldn't have to write the book. I could just tell you what it is. And when my current editor, asked me before I had written much of the book, what the book was about, I felt I had flattened the book into something without spirit by saying what it was about in this very linear narrative. And so I ended up writing something. It turned out to be 4,000 words. It was called About the About, which is about me and who I am as a writer. He ended up loving that piece so much, he said he wanted to publish it. He thought it should be something that many young writers would read, or new writers would read, and understand something about the nature of writing and themselves in it. And that then became the seed of the possibility of a book. his seed, not mine, his idea that we should write this book. And I say we because part of what he wanted to include were the emails that we exchanged back and forth on the writing of this novel, a thought that horrified me, actually, when he first brought it up and made me say that I would not write him another email ever if he thought he would do this. He said he wouldn't do that, and then he brought it up again when we were finished with the novel and still said he thought we should include emails, some of the emails. Obviously, just a few, because there were about 1,500 emails exchanged between us. And I thought about it later that it might be interesting for people to see how one editor and one writer works together in the creation of a book. Probably is not what most people think.
One final question. Joy Luck Club became a film. Is there any interest in your other books at this point?
A lot of people ask me about making this current book into a film. I mean, non-film people. They already have it cast in their minds, in fact. I don't think of my books that way. As I'm writing them, they're more real to me than they are taken to that other level, a more artificial level of a film. I know there was some interest, and everything is so tenuous in the film world that I would never say that something is going to be a movie or that there's interest unless money was paid on the table and you get to actually see it and touch it, and if tickets are sold. Other than that, you know, everything is just hype when it comes to the movies. I had a very good experience making Joy Luck Club, and I came to the table with that attitude. And I always said, you know, you never know until somebody's paid for a ticket that it's a movie. And we ended up getting total creative control, you know, just simply with that idea. It's never a movie until later. You can always say no, because somebody might end up saying no for you later down the line. So it was a good way to approach a movie, and it was a wonderful experience that I know I'll never be able to replicate, so why even try? If somebody wants to make a movie of this book, great. You know, they can have the story. I'm staying home and writing more books.
You've been listening to an interview with Amy Tan, whose latest novel is The Valley of Amazement. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.